Welcome to the RFS podcast, changing the landscape for military spouses all over the world and returning talent to the workplace.
I'm Hannah Kendrick, and we have created this podcast to give you maximum success in your career. We'll talk to experts in the field of employment, specialists, even psychologists, as well as stories from other military spouses to help you get the best out of your career journey. Welcome to the RFS podcast. Now, today we will be speaking with Lucy Key, performance coach. Lucy is from an organisation called Performing Perfectly, and you may ask, why are we speaking to her on the RFS podcast? Now, Lucy has amazing experience behind helping people to be the better version of yourself when presenting. So whether that's an interview, whether that's online, doing a presentation, public speaking, I myself have worked with Lucy and she is phenomenal. She is amazing. Now, bringing the world of theatre to your business is their tagline, and I think there couldn't be a better tagline than that. Lucy and her team support you in bringing expertise from the world of theatre. Lucy herself has been an actress on the West End, but also her husband, Chris, is a director of Les Mis. They've also worked in theatre productions like The Wizard of Oz, The School of Rock. And so we're very, very lucky to have Lucy here today. Lucy, welcome to the RFS podcast.
Thank you very much for welcoming me. Hi, Helleth. I am an actress by background. So having trained as an actress from the age of 18 at Guildford School of Acting and performing full time for many years in predominantly musicals, when I had my children, I didn't want to do 8 shows a week anymore. And Performing Perfectly sort of came about by accident, really. My husband and I were working in the West End and my husband was directing Les Mis and was approached by the FA and was asked if he would do a keynote speech about effective communication and performance, comparing it between football and theatre. And we thought, there's no comparison, you know, they're so fit and what we do is completely different. Elite performance is completely different. But when we sat down, we realised actually there was huge similarities. So who sits on the bench, who's the understudies, how do you manage that pressure continually 8 shows a week or performing in front of huge audiences, how do you manage egos, different personalities in the cast, how do you cast these shows in the first place, how do you recruit football in the first place, how do you give bad news when people have to go. So this was a real success, and from then we then formed a great relationship with the FA and do a lot of work with them on essentially what is effective communication. And what we realised very quickly was this was a real niche but very necessary in lots of organisations. So we now work in many organisations, lots of sports organisations, but also the NHS, for example, we work a lot with, delivering courses and training on just that, effective communication, and whether that be with dysfunctional teams, whether it's with people that are wanting to be able to interview better or present better, whether it's confidence building, or storytelling, all sorts of things. So this was about 7 or 8 years ago, essentially in a nutshell, what we have now designed and what we're doing, as well as still performing and directing as well.
You quickly scooted through the fact that you were doing 8 shows in the West End a week. That's no easy feat. That's quite full on, isn't it? And I think if you could give the audience a little bit of background.
So most West End shows and touring shows, musicals and plays, will do 8 shows a week, sometimes more around periods like Christmas when they want to increase their revenue, as you can imagine. So most actors are used to that, but it is grueling and it is full on. I think physically and mentally, you certainly build resilience very quickly. What might be a slight cold for many people has a different effect on an actor, because your voice is your instrument. And that's when I became very interested actually in the voice, because even if you're feeling perfectly well, if you've got a hoarse voice, you can't perform, you can't sing. So you have to learn to look after your body in a different way. Even if you're healthy, you have to really think about using your body as a tool. And that's something that I do now talk a lot about when I'm training. People often are complacent about what they have. And even if you're physically fit, you don't necessarily understand what you have at your disposal. But yeah, 8 shows a week was certainly grueling. And sometimes it's easier than other times, depending on what you've got on in your life. But certainly when you have children, for example, it's a completely different kettle of fish than when you're young and in your 20s and performing in those shows. My first show was a show called Of the I Sing, which is a Gershwin musical, which is lesser known, but a beautiful, beautiful show. And I left drama school slightly earlier to do that. But it was a very short run. I think it was about 8 weeks. And then from there, I had auditioned and I got offered the role of Consuela, which is actually a smaller role to start with in West Side Story. It was the understudy of Maria. And then when that girl left, I was then bumped up to the lead role as Maria, and then continued to play her for a long time, and then went on a tour. So I ended up playing Maria for probably 18 months of my life. So it's vocally very challenging because it's a very high sing. But actually, emotionally, it's very challenging because I don't know whether you know the story of West Side Story. It's still very prevalent today. But these two gangs, I suppose, the Puerto Ricans and the Americans, that have this, you know, real rivalry, and Maria is Puerto Rican and Tony is American, and they fall in love. So it's a very difficult relationship because it's not allowed, and so it happens in secret, and it ends in tragedy. It's based on Romeo and Juliet. So especially the end of that show was tremendously tricky, because when Tony dies in her arms, you have to deliver this huge speech where you're crying and screaming, and you have to do that 8 times a week. It's emotionally very draining, but you also have to find a way of doing it technically as well, so that you're protecting yourself, one, emotionally, and two, from hurting yourself. But it was an amazing experience, and I think one that I will always cherish. And if I'm honest, I look back on it now and I think, I don't know whether I enjoyed it as much as I would have hoped, because the anxiety and the pressure that I felt was such that it took its toll on me, I think, a little bit. Whereas actually, now I'm older and in my 40s and I've had children and experienced other things in my life, I realise that actually I probably put too much pressure on myself. But at that time in my life, it was the most important thing, and therefore it was my world, you know. But an incredible experience nonetheless.
And how did you protect yourself when you were doing those shows and you were doing such an emotional scene 8 times a week?
Well, interestingly, if I'm honest, I don't think I did very well. And the one thing that I can paint up for now and feel very strongly about is that there is very little training for that. I think it's improving now, and when we do work with sports people and other organisations, I think it's only the last sort of decade really that people are understanding the importance of well-being in the workplace, and how it's so important to nurture your employees, the people that you're working with. And actually, when I was at drama school, it was very much about, this is how you sing, this is how you dance, this is how you act. Vigorous training, you know, hugely long hours, but there was nothing about diet or mental health. How did you cope with going to numerous auditions and not getting the part after 10 auditions? And then, of course, how to cope when you're in a show and how to sustain that for 8 shows a week. So it's something that I think I learned on the job, and I quickly realised, okay, I can't go out and party like I did when I was at drama school, because it impacts on my voice, you know, it dehydrates the voice, and so I can't sing as well. And it was quite lonely at times, because I would have to spend a lot of time resting my voice during the day and not socialising in the way that some of the members of the cast were. So that was tricky as well. So I think it's something that really I learnt as I went, and then subsequent jobs, it got easier because I knew what worked and what didn't. But the truth is, it was something I had to learn the hard way, I think.
So you're used to doors slamming in your faces and building that resilience. That's what you did at that time.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And the amount of times, I've got such vivid memories of sitting on the train or the tube and phoning my mum in tears saying, I haven't got it. I don't know why I'm doing this stupid job, you know, because it's heart-wrenching. Sometimes you've put, you know, weeks and weeks of work into audition material and going back and performing in, you know, different panels and feeling very strongly, yeah, I've got this, and then getting the call that you haven't. Having said that, the call that you get that says you have got the part, there's nothing like the buzz or the thrill of that. But it, you know, you really are up there in terms of a high or down there in terms of a low, and it's you do get used to it, but it doesn't necessarily get any easier, I wouldn't say.
Somebody once described it as dizzying highs and devastating lows in acting.
Yeah, that's so accurate.
And you kind of rode that roller coaster very well, but what kind of made you keep going when you were those days when you were sort of on the train feeling probably really at a low? Can you remember what was the thing that kept you going?
Probably a very sort of deep-rooted self-belief. I think you can be knocked and knocked and knocked, but I think I was very fortunate that I was I was very supported in terms of my family and friends. And especially when you've had a role and you've performed it and you've got good feedback, I think I just had to hang on to that. And in those times of real stress and real kind of heightened anxiety or worry that you're not going to get the next job, I think something inside me was like, this is what you're supposed to do. This is what you're meant. You're good at it. You can do it. And it was that voice that I was able to tune into at times when I felt at my lowest. And it's something I suppose even at the time I perhaps didn't realise that I had, and I credit the people around me for that and myself. But I think it's sometimes very difficult to hang on to that self-belief, because it's very easy for it to be knocked out of you when other people are getting roles over you or you're not getting where you want to get. But I think if you can just keep that nugget and go, I can do this. I'm a great believer in mindset and how we have a real ability to control a lot of the thoughts and feelings that we have. And we can't often control what happens around us, but we can control how we respond to that. And so I think I have got a grit and a determination and drive, and have done since I was a child. I think I was quite a driven, difficult, dramatic child at times. But it's probably served me well now, because as an adult, I'm like, actually, I'm going to do this and you can't tell me that I'm not going to. So I think that was probably the thing that kept me going.
Do you think there's anything that made you, because people often look back at a certain event or their childhood or something that makes them have that grit and that determination and that difference. Is there anything, one thing that happened, do you think, as a child, or was it just your upbringing?
The thing that I thought about a lot, I always loved performing, and I think I was one of these children that knew that's what I wanted to do from the minute I was able to experience it. But my dad actually got into Bristol Old Vic when he was 18, which was and still is one of the most prestigious drama schools. But he lived in a council estate in Nottingham, very working class upbringing and parents. His dad was a miner, my nan was a dinner lady. And when he got into that school, was laughed at essentially by his parents, who said, well, don't be ridiculous. You've got to get a proper job. We couldn't possibly afford that, and totally poo-pooed it. So possibly one of the things that gave me that grit was that I knew that my dad was absolutely behind me and my mum. They're separated. They weren't together, but both of them were very supportive. There was none of this kind of, oh, well, you know, it's very tricky business and he might not be able to make it, which a lot of other people were hearing from their parents. But I think knowing that my dad had been given an opportunity that he wasn't able to take, I think made me go, I'm going to take every opportunity that's thrown my way and I'm going to do it, even if I get knocked back. So I think that probably impacted me, knowing that he wanted to do it and couldn't. And I was now given this opportunity that I could.
And you and your husband, Chris, are an amazing team. Now, he is the director of Les Mis, and not just here in the UK, but around the world. Is that right?
His role now really is international director. So he's less involved with it in London now, because his main role is to take it and other shows. It's not just Les Mis, all around the world, literally, which is a fascinating experience. And we've just been to South Korea with him. Actually, this Christmas, he was doing School of Rock out there. Sometimes it's in English. Most of the time it's in their native language, so you'll work a lot with translators. It's an incredibly interesting, manic, chaotic life that we lead, but one that we love.
Amazing.
Probably wouldn't change.
That's amazing. And so, in sort of aligned with that, as you mentioned earlier, you've created Performing Perfectly, which is what you do to sort of work with companies, sports players. So let's talk about the Football Association and how you came about that. And I mean, you'd think, you know, what's the similarities really between sport, football, and acting? I mean, I know now, but most people would probably think, what are they? So how did you get to work with the Football Association?
Chris was asked specifically to do this keynote speech. And I think what they realised after that was actually how important their communication was. And I think traditionally, you know, years ago, actually, sports organisations, especially football, actually, had a bit of a culture of humiliation and bullying. And actually, it wasn't until people like Gareth Southgate came into their work that realised actually that wasn't getting the best results. When you nurtured and valued your players, you got better results. So I think what's happened over recent years is how you communicate with the people on your team, whether that's a team of NHS nurses, whether it's footballers, whether it's teachers, can be the difference between them performing well and not performing well. And it's common sense, but it's not common practice. And when people feel listened to and respected and understood and are given space and support, then they perform in a way that is good for everybody in that organisation. And I think what the FA entrusted us with very, very soon, very early on in our sort of career with Performing Perfectly, was actually they needed some help with that. And they said, look, we're not sure if the coaches are communicating properly with the footballers. We're not sure if we are getting the best out of them. Can you help? So we started going in and we now work on a module with them, which is part of the pro license course. So the pro license course is what you have to do. It's the last sort of badge that you have to take if you want to manage internationally. And there'll be a huge global diverse group of people that will be taking that course from all different cultural backgrounds. But what they have in common is it's about how do they engage their coaches, their players, to encourage these players to play at the top of their game and to score goals ultimately. So what we do is break that down. How do they use their voice? How do they use their body language? How do they communicate with each person differently? Because each player will have different needs and come from different cultures and will respond differently depending on the environments that they've inhabited and the environments they're inhabiting now. And it's really interesting. And as I've researched the voice and body language as over the last few years, as I've gone on this journey, it's just made me more and more passionate about just how important it is to be able to learn. And it is about learning what you have at your disposal and the impact that you have on individuals and how you have a responsibility, but also the ability to be able to change the outcome of something purely by how you deliver a message, for example. And it's something I'm really passionate about now.
And you do it so well. And it's something that I met you through the BEST programme, the keynote speaking programme through Leon Lloyd and Paul McVeigh. And I was amazed at how we turned up into a room and you said, right, we're going to sing. I was like, what do you mean? I know I'm Welsh, but I don't sing. But talk about that kind of feeling of how do you kind of get somebody from going, I am not singing. You know, they've got their arms folded, they're a sort of sports PE person, and you walk in and you're just great in so many ways, but you start to sing and you do this great thing about changing accents, because you go from speaking a sort of Liverpudlian accent to a very posh accent to
different. Absolutely, it's me party trick, Helen. Absolutely. Well, I talk a lot about how, you know, different voices influence the way that we understand people. So, for example, you know, when I was at college, I would use a Liverpudlian accent if I wanted to do something funny, because it had, you know, funny connotations. But actually, that's not necessarily, you know, a Liverpudlian person might be quite offended by that. And the point is, it's getting people to understand the impact that their voice has. Paul McVeigh, you talked about, you know, is from Belfast. And so I will often talk to him like this and say, listen to how much lower my voice is. If I'm from Belfast, I'm talking down there, whereas Lucy speaks here, you know, as if I was from, you know, the East End, I'd be here and it's much more monotone. And you might go, my God, she's, you know, she's really forthright. And how does she know? Because it's got, again, different connotations. And I talk about the news. And, you know, years ago, if you listen to the news, it was heightened RP, received pronunciation. So everybody spoke like that. And then everybody was taught a more neutral RP. So sort of a neutral, accentless voice. And it's only more recently that more regional accents are becoming more accepted again. But, you know, there's still a lot of evidence behind accents. And there was something recently I read in The Guardian, actually, that said that a recent survey showed that if people had the choice between choosing a solicitor to represent them that had a regional accent or a neutral accent, they would prefer to go with a neutral accent, regardless of that person's experience or credentials, which it's mind-blowing, really. So there's an element of trust there. So it's something that I'm always looking into and asking questions about. Why the Scottish correspondence, but, you know, not Northern? You wouldn't have, you know, I know, you know, welcome to me, Lucy Key, reading the 6 o'clock news, and I don't know why, but for some reason, it's not acceptable. But it should be acceptable. One of the things that impacted me is when I went to drama school, I had a really strong Midlands accent. This is how I spoke. One of my head of musical theatre teachers said to me, Lucy, if you speak like that, you'll never get a job, because you sound thick.
Amazing.
And that really impacted me. And I've, you know, this is my voice actually, but I've totally got rid of that, because of how people perceive me. So it's a bit of a joke, but actually, when you strip it back, it isn't. And it's absolutely not about changing your accent, but it's about making people aware of how people perceive you, but also how you perceive others. And the reason we often get people to sing when we're doing our courses is to demonstrate just how much voice we have at our disposal. So whether you're musical or not, you know, an octave is 8 notes, and most people have about 3 octaves of notes available in their voice, and on average we use 5 of those a day. So we've got this incredible instrument that we don't really use, because we just tend to sit in this sort of middle part of our voice, which can be a bit boring and monotone. So by asking people to sing, you know, it's just demonstrating what they've got that they don't use.
But effective communication, which is as you said, whether it's you're speaking to your partner, whether you're speaking to your boss, whether you're in an interview situation, whether you're returning a pair of jeans, it makes all the difference. I know that you love your, without going into too much depth, because we could talk for so long about this, but give us some of your top tips.
I think my first top tip would be, which people don't like to hear, but listen to yourself back, watch yourself back, because actually, if you don't like what you hear or what you see, how on earth can you expect anybody else to? If you're going into a job interview, for example, you know, you want to see and hear what that person's seeing and hearing. And actually, knowing that you have the ability to be able to communicate in a way that you decide, as opposed to just, oh, well, this is how I speak. So practicing, it sounds silly, but practice how you communicate, practice how you answer those questions. Notice people who are engaging, and equally notice people that really aren't. And what is it about those people that is capturing you? And what is it about those people that's switching you off? Because you have the ability to be so engaging in terms of the way that you speak, and pitch and tone and pause and dynamic and pace are just 4 of the things that I would get people to think about straight away, because we've all heard people speak in a really monotone way and at a very similar pace, and it's very easy to get switched off, and however interesting the content is. So switch it up, you know, and speak with passion and speak, you know, authentically, but listen to yourself back. Think about pitch and tone and all those other things I've just talked about. Whether you're online or in person, body language is so important, because you make a judgment within 5 seconds of meeting somebody, depending on their body language. I often say to people, how often do you switch the television on, for example, and you'll go, God, I don't like the look of them. You know, you don't know anything about them, haven't opened their mouth, but you've just decided you don't like the look of them. And equally, you'll see somebody in Sainsbury's and think, oh, they look lovely. But yeah, they might be horrible, but you've just decided. Yeah. So when you think about it, we have this, incredible innate ability to make judgments immediately, and you have the opportunity to influence that judgment. And the only way you can influence it is to be able to watch yourself back and go, okay, what is everybody else seeing when I walk into that room and when I sit down? And so, yeah, I think watching yourself back would be my top tip.
So a military spouse has got an interview. She sent out 40 applications and she's got her first interview for 8 years. She's on the way there. She's got sweaty palms. She's, you know, spilt her coffee. She's had a bad morning. And then she goes into this interview and her mindset is not good. She's probably thinking, she or he, because there are male spouses out there, is thinking, oh my God, why am I here? What am I doing? What on earth am I doing? This is just an admin job. What would you say to that person at that moment before they go into that job interview?
Yeah, so I'd say change your internal dialogue. We all talk to ourselves, don't we? That's just a normal part of life. But also, we're pretty horrible to ourselves a lot of the time. If you really analyse, oh, I shouldn't be here, I'm not very good at this, all those things you just said there, Helen, is very true. And again, we have control of our thoughts. And I think for a long time, I would stand in the wings before I was about to go on and perform at a huge concert or on the West End stage, and I'd be saying, oh God, what if I forget my lines? What if I'm overcome by anxiety? What if I forget this again? Oh God, what if my voice cracks on that note? And actually all I'm doing is, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, is I'm giving myself those negative messages. And as soon as I learn to change those is, you know, into, I've got this. I'm here because I deserve to be. For example, actually that begins to calm us down. And the other thing that I talk a lot about, because it has multiple benefits, is breathing and understanding how to breathe properly. So for that military wife or husband that's in the car, that's dropped the coffee, that's about to go, the first thing I would do is would give them a breathing exercise that's going to calm them down, that's going to lower their heart rate, that's going to concentrate their thinking. So they're actually thinking about the breath in, the breath out, which is going to in turn help their voice. You know, it's not going to crack, they're not going to speak too quickly, but also give them some hints and techniques around mindset and what they're saying to themselves, because that's the biggest problem. And I think it's what a lot of people struggle with. And my sister, who's an executive coach and deals a lot with the psychology behind performance and confidence and communication, and many of us go through life with lots of what we call self-limiting beliefs, whether that's I can't speak in public without feeling dreadfully nervous, or I'm not very good at public speaking, or I'm rubbish in interviews, I never get them. And it's usually because there's been a trigger. Maybe you've had a really nasty experience of being bullied. Maybe you have, somebody's given you some feedback that you're boring. Maybe you've gone for a job interview and it went dreadfully wrong and you didn't get it, and those scar us emotionally, and it can be very tricky to get rid of that trauma, and therefore it becomes almost a phobic response. So learning that actually we can undo that just by learning how to use your voice and body language and breathing and thinking about what you say to yourself, and it can be really life-changing for people. But what I love is people very quickly make shifts, you know, shift their thinking very quickly. And if you don't mind me sharing this, Helen, you know, you were speaking recently and you said to me, have you got any advice? And I think I said, because you'd said to me, I'm worried I'm going to not know what to say or forget what to say. And my advice to you, wasn't it, was, you know what you know. Just trust that you know what you know. And in a job interview, for example, you know what you know. So we worry so much and consume so much time, you know, worrying about, oh God, what if they ask me this? Trust that you know the answers. Know that you can breathe and know that you've got time, with the use of pause, for example, to say, yeah, let me think about that for a moment. Okay, and then, you know, come back. Actually, you know what you know. But people get so wound up about what ifs and hypotheticals that they don't live in the moment, and then things go wrong.
And your advice was amazing, because ever since I've worked with you, I used to get terrible. The other podcast I did with a chap called Don McPherson, we were talking about this, and that feeling of getting really sort of sweaty palms and very nervous is something I don't get anymore. Mm-hmm. Which I get the nerves before, probably a few hours before, but then once you get on, as you say, your training and that breathing and that sort of reframing is so important. So I always say to my team, never forget what it's like to be, you know, that spouse who is stuck at home and can't get work. What would you say to that person who has got crippling anxiety about getting a job or feels that they're not worthy? What would you say to that person who is kind of at a loss as to, well, where do I start? I don't even have anything to wear to an interview. Where do I start? What would you say to that person?
Small steps. You know, I think sometimes we think so far into the future and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. Actually, small steps. But I think the first thing that I would encourage them to do is to really understand what they are good at, and whether that's a journal they keep, whether it's writing it down. But what we know as human beings, and what I've learnt over the years of doing this training myself, is that we hold on to the negatives. Somebody said to me once, and I love it, that negative comments and negative thoughts stick to us like Velcro, and positives slide off us like Teflon. And I thought, I love that, because it's so true. You know, somebody could say 10 good things to you, but you remember the one bad thing. And it takes practice to change that mindset. So actually writing down, if that was that person that feels, what can I give? What can I offer? Actually, I'm really good at admin. I'm really good at organising things, for example. You know, write it down and start to focus on the things you're good at, as opposed to the things that you're not. And then in terms of the crippling anxiety, actually understanding that anxiety actually does create lots of these physical symptoms that people find really crippling. But understanding that those symptoms are not harmful, and they are just physical responses and feelings that we can get a hold of. So, for example, you know, one thing that I discovered at drama school was that I struggled quite a lot with anxiety. And when I went to the doctor, she said to me, you are in a constant state of hyperventilation. And hyperventilation is essentially when you're over-breathing all the time. And because of that, I was experiencing all those physical symptoms of the sweaty palms and the didn't feel like I could get enough breath and heart racing. And actually, just by understanding how to breathe properly, I could then get that control back. That is something that I would massively advise people. And you can find that in yoga. You can find it in Pilates. You can find it in doing an ice bath. You can find it just by reading up on it and understanding how to do it and learning a few exercises. So really simple things, you know, do a breathing exercise and make a journal would be the first thing I'd say. And then start to dip your toe in. But I think just being conscious of what you're saying to yourself and letting some of those beliefs go and creating new ones is a must.
That's amazing. Now, I'd love to talk about the workshop that we did with you with RFS, because we did it through our Career Academy. I can't remember how many spouses we had on. We had quite a lot. Go through for your personal, your own sort of personal experience on how you found that. It's obviously you'd never worked with military spouses before, but what were the things that jumped out at you at the beginning, and then what did you see at the end?
I think what I loved about it, and what I love about what I do now in general, is sort of the unlocking. I feel like sometimes I'm in a very privileged position that I give people the opportunity to unlock a potential that perhaps they've kept hidden or they've kept pushing down, because it's not about being falsely positive. That isn't what it is. But it's about allowing somebody to really focus on their qualities, what they have at their disposal, and make really significant but very quick shifts in their thinking patterns. So just people's confidence from the beginning of that workshop to the end grew massively when they realised, wow, all I have to do is implement this and this, and it feels very different. And all I have to do is maybe do a breathing exercise before I go in, and it's calming my nerves. And maybe all I have to do is pause a bit more when I'm speaking, and it's far more interesting. So giving people very quick, easy hints and tips on things like pausing. I think we used scripts, didn't we? And I got people to read scripts and experiment with what it feels like to read somebody else's words and how to make them as engaging as possible. And then people suddenly go, wow, I can do this myself. So it's about encouraging people to always be authentic, but also to find a version of themselves that is their most confident, most professional, most successful, that they can sort of step into, whether it's going into that interview or into that workplace or even into that social situation. Because I'm a big believer that we all have multiple identities and we all have multiple versions of ourselves. And that's not being unauthentic. It's just about understanding what your core values are and then deciding how you need to be in each different situation to get the best outcomes and to go in there with a fresh, clean mindset, as opposed to carrying all this baggage of what if this happens or this happened before. And so, yeah, it was a really fun workshop. I'm very much about making it as interactive and as engaging as possible, so people felt they could ask questions, they could experiment, they could do lots of different exercises and techniques in small groups and with us, to then be able to feel and see the benefits of the training and then be able to put it into practice immediately. And that's what I feel most proud of, really, when people say, last week I went into a job interview and I didn't feel as nervous and I felt I was really engaging, and that's because you taught me about pause, and that's because I learned how to do a power pose before. And you think, yeah, simple things can make a massive, massive difference.
But what you managed to do, I mean, which was, I think, you know, you're very modest because you've got so much lived experience. You're not sort of preaching from somewhere that you haven't experienced all those feelings yourself that you described earlier. But what I noticed, because I had to jump on early and then I had to do other stuff and come back later, the difference in the confidence, and this is online, that you had in the spouses that we were working with. I mean, the comments that we got back, I mean, they were jumping out of the page at us saying, wow, that was incredible. That was far beyond what they expected. And they really, really enjoyed it. And I think obviously we'll be doing it again with you. But for me, what really sort of jumped out at me was the complete transformation in their confidence after 2 hours of working with you, which was amazing, online as well.
I think the other thing is, they enjoyed getting real-time feedback. And often especially in jobs, people will do a 360 feedback, or people will have an appraisal, or people will be, but not very often are we given direct feedback and actually given positive feedback as well. And one thing that my husband often talks about is, as a director, as a theatre director, and I've done a bit of directing as well, although more performing, but your job is to maintain those standards. So Chris will be travelling all over the world to see a production of Les Mis, which will be fantastic. And you go and see it and go, wow. But Chris's job is to go in and look at that and go, yeah, okay, that was brilliant, but, you know, this wasn't working quite right. Or, you know, maybe that scene's lost its mojo a bit. We'll rework that. And actually, there was a problem there with the lighting. And actually, I wasn't sure about this. And several years ago, he was working with a Japanese gentleman in Japan, and sat him down and said, right, okay, so we need to look about this, we need to rework this, and gave him all this feedback. And he stopped him and he said, can I just ask a question? Have I done anything right? And at that point, Chris said, it was like a light bulb moment. And he thought, my God, all I've done is told him what's wrong, whereas actually most of it is brilliant. And he had to say, no, you're doing everything right. All I'm doing is giving you some hints and tips. But it totally changed the way that he gave what we call in the theatre world notes. You know, you give notes all the time. And I think on the work that I did with the military spouses, it was about actually telling people what they were really good at. That was brilliant. Now add in a bit of this. Now have a go at that. Yeah, that's fantastic. And again, this is not about being falsely positive, but people are just used to hearing what they're not good at or what needs improvement. And actually what we know is when people are given that, that's really good. Now add in a bit of this. Actually, it can be really transformative for people and give them that bit of confidence that they were possibly lacking in order to be able to go into that interview or situation that they want to impress in and feel differently. We're not very nice to ourselves or each other a lot of the time. And actually, it's not useful. It's not useful. So, of course, we also need to be able to look at what our areas of development. Of course we do. But we have to equally look at what we're good at and what we can make even better. You know?
Yeah. That's amazing. And the effective communication is exactly what you're saying there. I remember standing up and you were like, slow down and take a pause.
Slow down.
Yeah.
What's interesting with that is that you are naturally very fast and I am naturally very fast. It's my personality, but I can't use that as an excuse. I have to think, okay, I'm on a podcast here or I'm training a group of people here. So I have to consciously slow myself down. But I don't think you've been too fast at all on this podcast. And I think what you do brilliantly is you're clearly very passionate about the work that you do. And that, for me, is the most engaging a person can be. Actually, I can give you all the advice about pitch and tone and voice, but it's about emotional connection for me. I personally believe that it's about emotional connection. And when you build rapport with people, then actually it's much easier to get on board with them, whether it's somebody you're interviewing or whether you're trying to influence or persuade or sell a product. If that person likes you, then you're already halfway there. No. And I think you're very likeable. And that's that's what people are going to hang on to. Because if we're likeable, then people are going to trust. It's about trust, isn't it?
I think as well, one of the things that you taught us, which I thought was very funny, I was with Chris Sutton, the footballer at the time, and I hate name dropping, but he was so funny in this. When you said one of your top tips was to make people laugh, and I remember him looking at me going, I don't make people laugh, that's not my job. But you don't go up there and make a fool of yourself. But I do use that sometimes in, you know, when I'm speaking in public, but it does really help. Give us an example of how, if you are standing in front of people, you wouldn't obviously want to crack a joke in an interview situation, but how do you lighten the situation? How do you lighten if it's a little bit of a difficult situation, how would you enlighten that really?
I think humour is a hugely underestimated skill and form of communication that we probably don't use as much as we could or should. And I think the tricky thing is, obviously there are appropriate and inappropriate ways, but especially in the workplace, when we are being professional, I think people are often scared to sometimes be their authentic selves. And certainly the idea of making a joke or being self-deprecating or saying anything that's funny is going to somehow devalue them or make them less authentic or less professional. And actually that couldn't be further from the truth. I think if you think about, regardless of your political preferences, for example, if you take a politician, in my opinion, they can be sometimes so overcoached and over slick that you end up not really believing anything they say at all. Whereas I always say, if somebody can be vulnerable and allow us to just step into their world for a moment, and if people can also laugh at themselves or you know, find something funny and able to do that, then actually it's the most human thing that we have. And so even if we are in a job interview, it's not, you know, it's not about doing a knock joke, but if you stumble over a word, for example, or you want to say something and it's funny, then I would absolutely encourage that. We are human beings, and it's that human connection that we thrive on.
Yeah.
And it's an emotional connection that we have. We do a lot of work now around stories and the importance of storytelling. And you know, if people are selling an idea or selling a project or selling themselves, one of the best ways to do that is by telling a story. We do it all the time. We do it in the pub with our friends. But when you allow yourself to tell a story, what you're doing is you're stepping into a more vulnerable state, and it's such an appealing state for you to, and you feel very privileged to be able to listen to that. So I would always encourage people to not be frightened of showing vulnerability and allowing themselves to laugh when appropriate, and to have that sense of humour, because life can be too serious, and there's times when it's not appropriate, but most of the time I would argue.
We've just had an event a couple of weeks ago actually, and one of our team, Rusilla, had to speak in public in front of some very senior talent, you know, global talent specialists, and she was very nervous, and she had in front of her her computer, and as she was her laptop, and as she was speaking, the laptop froze, and there was this moment where she paused, and I was sitting kind of quite close, and it felt like 5 minutes, but it must have been 10 seconds. Her confidence and then she said, well, I'm just going to speak, but she had this moment of vulnerability, and she paused. And oh my God, did she have the room? She completely and utterly had the room, because she showed this vulnerability, and she wasn't trying to make something up, but people could totally see through that.
Or pretend it hadn't happened. Yeah.
Yeah. People instantly connected with her, and they didn't feel sorry for her. They didn't feel pity. They just immediately connected with what she was, you know, what she was trying to do. And she didn't say, blame it on something else, or just stood there and held it, which was really powerful, actually.
Laptops break and things freeze. Yep. And it's again, it's all about how you deal with that. But people like to have that human connection. And I often talk about things like children in need or comic relief. Mm. And I think, you know, if we just sat down on a Friday night and you just had a series of facts that appeared on your screen, you know, this child hasn't eaten for 3 weeks, and X amount of children don't have water, you'd look at those facts and you'd probably think, oh God, that's sad. But the minute you see the footage, you see the physical pictures of the girl walking through the desert, you know, having walked for a long time, and the little boy that's not dressed properly, it completely impacts, you know, on a different wavelength. And then on top of that, you then have the very carefully, deliberately chosen voice of the celebrity that's saying, this is little Helleth who's been walking through the desert for however many, and you hear that story, then we connect on an even deeper level. And then just to tip us right over the edge, you have the music, which again has been selected to give us an emotional response. And it's then that you are more likely to pick up the phone and go, I'm going to donate 50 quid. And it's manipulation in a way, but I don't use that term in a negative way. You know, my brother's an osteopath. He manipulates people's joints back into place. But it's about manipulating your audience, whether that's one person or 1,000 people, to feel what you want them to feel, whether it's to make them laugh, whether it's to feel engaged, whether it's to entertain them, whether it's to change their minds on something, to shift their thinking on something. And all of those things are going to happen when you emotionally connect with them. And that, whenever I've seen speakers, the speakers that I remember are the speakers that have made me feel something. My favourite phrase is, and a psychologist that I work with told me this a few years ago, that real change happens at a feeling level. And I love that. Real change happens at a feeling level. When you get somebody to feel something, then they will shift in their thinking, whether it's buying your product or buying into you or changing their mind about something. But the only way you can do that is to make them feel something. We're manipulated all the time by the things that we're watching on television without realising. But you have the ability to do that as a person. Giving facts and figures. A job interview is a really good example, Helen, because you can stand there and go, these are my skills, this is what I do. But if you tell a story and say, well, actually, you know, if somebody asks you, for example, you know, what do you think's your best skill? Or what, actually give them an example of when that skill had to come to the fore. It's much more interesting than going, well, I can do X, Y, Z. People step into that story. Yeah. Emotional connection is so important.
That's so true. And we had a spouse just recently say to us that she switched. Most spouses will sit in an interview where they won't talk about their military life. And she said, look, I'm a military wife. I'm going to move on. But I can tell you this. She was able to describe to them why she was resilient, why she was adaptable, and why she was a good team player, and why they should employ her. And they gave her the job. And she said, I just owned it, and I explained the amazing skills that we have as a military spouse, and why would they not want those in an organisation? So she got the job. So I think, as you absolutely said, it's about how you deliver that, isn't it?
It absolutely is, absolutely. Because, like you say, if she hadn't have done that, they could have been then going, well, the thing is, you know, she's military spouse and she might be moving on.
Yeah.
And actually, just by telling her story and go, but this is what it means for me.
Yeah.
Stories are really powerful, and I think it's that combination of storytelling and then understanding what we have at our disposal and how lucky and blessed we are to have it. A good friend of mine is a motor neurone disease specialist nurse, and she will say to me, you know, lots of her patients will lose their ability to speak weeks or months before death, but that's the point of real decline, because it's that last part of yourself that has gone. And so she's a great believer and really fights for, which is what I fight for as well, which is this voice donation or being able to bank your own voice. Because, you know, what your voice means to your children, your parents, your family, your friends, what it can do for you is incredible. And yet people often say, oh, I hate my own voice, or I don't like the way I walk, or I don't like that. Well, learn to love it. And you can learn to love it because it's your superpower. You know, it really is. It's who you are. And imagine how it would feel not to have that. Change the dialogue. I've got this voice and I can sell myself in a way that nobody else can. How am I going to do it? And if all you're saying is, oh, I hate it, or I don't like my accent, or you know, you've got to find a way of changing that story and reinventing that and understanding how powerful it is. We're the only animals that have this incredible you know, ability to communicate on this level, because we have language. So it's, yeah, you can tell it's something I'm hugely passionate about.
Lucy, it's been absolutely amazing talking to you. I think I want to ask you to kind of sign us out in your kind of BBC accent, if you would, please.
Because thank you very much, Helen. It's been me, Lucy Key, at what's the time? I've lost the time, but thank you very much for having me.
It's been wonderful to have you, Lucy. Thank you so much for your time. We look forward to working with you again soon. Good luck with Performing Perfectly. How do people find you if they want to get in touch with you?
Just Google performingperfectly.com. All the information will be there.
And you do private coaching, you do team coaching.
One-to-one.
You know how to work with military spouses now as well, which is great.
I absolutely do, yes. Brilliant.
That was the RFS podcast, changing the landscape for military spouses all over the world and returning talent to the workplace. If you took value from the conversation, please use your app to follow or subscribe so you're notified of the next episode.